And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, www.freakradio.org. On Thursday, January 7th, 2016, I'd like to suggest that you have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write down names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, addresses, anything you need to know in order to take action. Let's start off with announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team, is having a restoration this Saturday, January 9th, 2016, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Baldwin Creek in Wilder Ranch State Park. Linda writes, Happy New Year, everyone, and let's get started back where we left off. We got a lot of work done on the Baldwin Bluffs, and the beautiful ocean views make it easy. We will continue our work on Cape Ivy removal at this splendid coastal site. The directions to Wilder Ranch are to take Highway 1 west through Santa Cruz and continue north to the turnoff on the left-hand side for Wilder Ranch. There will be a sign indicating the left turn. When you get to the kiosk, let the ranger know that you are volunteering for a habitat restoration and they'll give you a parking pass. Meet the group at the interpretive sign by the bathrooms in the parking lot at 10 a.m. and please be prompt. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Please wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, and it might be raining. But if things get particularly unpleasant, they call it a day. Tools are provided, but do bring your gloves and water. If you have questions, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 462-4041. You can email her at redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at packbell.net, or visit the webpage at www.cruzcnps.org. O-R-G, that's CRUZCNPS.org. And announcing the 2016 Earth First Winter Organizers Conference in Chumash Territory near Santa Barbara, California, February 10th through the 15th, in this announcement from the Dam Collective, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Howdy, fellow Earth Firsters. We are excited to announce the 2016 Earth First Organizers Conference will be held once again in Chumash Territory outside of Santa Barbara, California. In an effort to create a more intentional, focused, and fun space for this year's Organizers Conference, we are tweaking the format of the week a tad. Earth First has evolved greatly as a movement in its 30-plus year history, and we are optimistic that we can continue to grow and evolve as a movement by taking the time and space to dig deep into some of the issues we face today. Most of those who attended this summer's rendezvous in Vermont know Earth First continues to struggle, stutter, and stumble when it comes to dealing with race and racism within our movement. We have indeed come a long way from the racist rhetoric that occasionally disgraced the pages of the Earth First Journal through the 80s and 90s, but it is clear we still have much to learn. In light of this, and in the context of living in a country that has seen weeks on end of revolt against white power structures, continued terrorizing of communities of color, we are eager to dig in and explore issues of race, racism, and colonialism in the context of radical environmental organizing. We are also dedicating time during the week to evaluate our tactics and how we train, strengthen our prisoner support efforts, and build bridges with others fighting mass incarceration, talk about creating more internal structure, strengthening regional and national efforts and campaigns, and much more. We are dedicating a full 5 days for this organizers' conference, as opposed to the previous 3 days for the OC and 2 days for the winter rendezvous, which had become a tradition. We will be having meetings and trainings during the day and keeping evenings generally freed up for hanging out. Wednesday, February 10th is an arrival day. The agenda will begin the morning of the 11th and go through the afternoon of Monday, February 15th. There will not be a post-camp action this year. This is partly due to the lack of capacity on the organizing collective's part, but mostly out of a desire to have maximum time and energy focused on the agenda. Everyone who is committed to organizing under the banner of Earth First is encouraged to attend this year's organizing conference. We will leave it up to you as to whether or not you fit this definition. We are seeking to create a close-knit, intentional space where you can build trust with one another and work through some difficult issues. If you are just looking to hang out and party all week, this gathering is probably not for you. Don't worry, we'll party with you at the rendezvous this summer. You will need to RSVP by January 20th in order to get directions, but you can RSVP as Swamp Ass Tick Butter or whatever you happen to be calling yourself this week. They will not be posting the directions publicly, and you can find the place to RSVP at the earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. Homework. Yeah, that's right. We are going to be doling out a little homework for you to do ahead of the organizers' conference. It is hard to have productive conversation when folks are coming to the table with radically different understandings of and exposure to issues being discussed. We hope that by providing some readings and exercises ahead of time, we can come to the organizers' conference with more of a common understanding and language with which to discuss the agenda. You'll receive your homework after you RSVP. If you're hearing this, make sure it gets to everyone in your Earth First group or network. We encourage you to take the time to extend the invite to friends who may have taken a step back from Earth First, or for one reason or another just aren't in the loop these days. Earth First has engaged in militant resistance in defense of the Earth for over 30 years. We have weathered FBI raids, attempted assassinations, internal strife, and schisms, but we are still here, still fighting for the forests, swamps, deserts, prairies, and communities that we love. It is important to recognize that we are engaged in a long-term struggle. We aren't going to fix it all in this 1 week. We are excited to take the time this winter to slow down, take a step back together, and explore how we can continue to build a movement that embraces collective liberation while fighting for Earth liberation. See you in February, the Dam Collective. Once again, those dates, February 10th through the 15th in Santa Barbara, California, the 2016 Earth First Winter Organizers Conference. If you have any thoughts or questions, go send an email to dam@earthfirstjournal.org. That's dam@earthfirstjournal.org. Or go to www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire to find the article about the winter rendezvous and RSVP before January 20th. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. We've seen a significant increase in hunting pressure of buffalo just north of Yellowstone's boundary. As snows have deepened in Yellowstone, a few hundred buffalo have migrated into the Gardner Basin, seeking lower elevation habitat necessary for their survival. For many buffalo, instead of the life-giving grasses they require, they find bullets. Nearly 40 more of this country's last wild buffalo have been gunned down, raising the death toll to just under 100. Hunters tend to go for the biggest buffalo they can find, so in family groups this means buffalo mothers, with calves at their sides and babies in their wombs, are being killed. Calves are being orphaned and families torn apart. Most of the buffalo have been killed by Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribal members, nearly all at Beatty Gulch. Huge pickup trucks packed with hunting parties will literally park just outside Yellowstone's boundary at the Beatty Gulch trailhead, their occupants warm inside as they wait for buffalo to cross Beatty Gulch. This is not hunting. This is slaughter. Beatty Gulch is a choke point in one of the buffalo's most important migration corridors. It has been a death trap since state and treaty hunts started almost 10 years ago. For the buffalo, passing through Beatty Gulch is almost always a death sentence, and for the people who live just a few hundred yards from these killing fields, hunting at Beatty Gulch has been a huge controversy. Hunting here has also prevented buffalo from accessing the additional habitat they were supposedly granted in the Gardner Basin in 2011. They are either killed or can't make it through, or they turn and flee back into Yellowstone, where they will soon be trapped and shipped to slaughter. In an attempt to address these issues, tribes hunting under treaty rights offered a periodic ceasefire in the Beatty Gulch corridor. Unfortunately, given the details, it doesn't really help. The so-called ceasefire will be observed every other week, Monday through Thursday, yet in all of these years that buffalo hunting has taken place, not much hunting occurs on those days anyway. Hunting parties tend to arrive on Thursdays and spend the long weekend killing buffalo, then leave on Sunday or Monday. So in essence, the tribes have offered not to hunt during the times when they don't hunt anyway. New developments have also occurred this year on Church Universal and Triumphant land, which is adjacent to Beatty Gulch and is patchworked with Gallatin National Forest land on the west side of the Yellowstone River. Church Universal and Triumphant has started to give permission to state hunters to kill buffalo on their land, wanting to give youth and elderly hunters opportunities to kill buffalo, and they also intend to use hunting as a tool to disperse buffalo that dare to step on their grass. There is hardly a safe place for wild buffalo in the Gardner Basin, not even inside Yellowstone National Park. This week, the Interagency Bison Management Plan partners released their final operations plans for 2016, announcing that they intend to kill 600 to 900 wild buffalo through so-called hunting and slaughter. The IBMP accomplices are aiming to drastically drive the world's most important bison population down, all at the behest of livestock interests. Slaughter, they said, would begin by February 15th and would continue to the end of March. Hunting will likely still be taking place during this time. By the end of March, buffalo calving season will be just a few short weeks away. We are fighting like hell to end the killing, stop the harassment, and open up Montana for buffalo to once again roam free. After 18 years of applying endless pressure, we won the buffalo's right to access Horse Butte year-round, but we still have a long way to go. Governor Bullock's decision to grant year-round habitat on Horse Butte indicates he is listening, though livestock interests clearly have him wrapped around their finger. Please keep the pressure on. You can contact the Buffalo Field Campaign at P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana. Their zip code 59758. That's Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, zip code 59758. Their phone number, 406-646-0070. Once again, 406-646-0070. And their webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org, where you can find this and a whole bunch more information about wild buffalo. That's www.buffalofieldcampaign, all one word, .org. Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And the Yurok tribe has adopted an ordinance banning frankenfish and GMOs, in this story from Intercontinental Cry. The Yurok tribe, the largest Indian tribe in California with over 6,000 members, has banned genetically engineered salmon and all genetically engineered organisms on their reservation on the Klamath River in this state's northwestern region. The Yurok ban comes in the wake of Federal Food and Drug Administration decisions in November to approve genetically engineered salmon dubbed frankenfish as being fit for human consumption, in spite of massive public opposition to the decision by fishermen, tribes, environmental organizations, and public interest organizations. On December 10th, the Yurok Tribal Council unanimously voted to enact the Yurok Tribe Genetically Engineered Organism Ordinance. The vote took place after several months of committee drafting and opportunity for public comment, according to a news release from the tribe and the Northern California Tribal Court Coalition. This ordinance is apparently the first of its kind in the United States to address the FDA's approval of Aqua Bounty Technologies' application for Aqua Advantage salmon, an Atlantic salmon that reaches market size more quickly than non-genetically engineered farm-raised Atlantic salmon, as well as all GMOs. The tribal GEO ordinance prohibits the propagation, raising, growing, spawning, incubating, or releasing of genetically engineered organism, such as growing GMO crops or releasing genetically engineered salmon within the tribe's territory, and declares the Yurok Reservation to be a GMO-free zone. While other tribes, such as the Diné, also known as the Navajo Nation, have declared GMO-free zones by resolution, this ordinance appears to be the first of its kind in the nation, the tribe said. On April 11, 2013, the Yurok tribe enacted an American Indians a resolution opposing genetically engineered salmon and then secured a grant from the National Congress of American Indians to support the tribe's work in continuing to protect ancestral lands, including waters, traditional learning and teaching systems, seeds, animal-based foods, medicinal plants, salmon, sacred places, and the health and well-being of the tribe's families and villages. GMO farms, whether they are cultivating fish or fresh produce, have a huge negative impact on watersheds the world over, the tribe stated. The Yurok people have managed and relied upon the abundance of salmon on the Klamath River since time immemorial. The tribe has a vital interest in the viability and survival of the wild native Klamath River salmon species and all the traditional food sources, the release said. James Dunlap, chairman of the Yurok tribe, said the Yurok people have the responsibility to care for our natural world, including the plants and animals we use for our foods and medicines. This ordinance is a necessary step to protect our food sovereignty and to ensure the spiritual, cultural, and physical health of the Yurok people. GMO food production systems, which are inherently dependent on the overuse of herbicides, pesticides, and antibiotics, are not in our best interest. The ordinance allows for enforcement of violations through the Yurok Tribal Court. Yurok Chief Judge Abby Abinanti stated, "It is the inherent sovereign right of the Yurok people to grow plants from native traditional seeds and to sustainably harvest plants, salmon, and other fish, animals, and other life-giving foods and medicines in order to sustain our families and communities as we have successfully done since time immemorial. Our court will enforce any violations of these inherent and now codified rights." The Tribal Council passed the ordinance at a critical time for West Coast salmon and steelhead. The Klamath River, located on the tribe's homeland, is plagued by massive algal blooms exacerbated by agricultural runoff and antiquated hydroelectric dams that turn the river toxic each summer. The tribe is working with other tribes, environmentalists, fishing groups, and elective officials to remove four dams on the Klamath River to restore this river's salmon, steelhead, and fish populations. The tribe in September withdrew from the controversial Klamath agreements and in December announced it strongly opposes draft legislation from U.S. Representative Greg Walden of Oregon to address Klamath River Basin water issues. And you can find more about this issue and other Native American news at www.intercontinentalcry.org. That's intercontinentalcry.org. And a militia has mustered to transfer Paiute land to mining and ranching interests in this story written by Steve Russell of Indian Country Today, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Some of the same armed militia involved in the Cliven Bundy affair in Nevada have occupied federal land in Oregon, formerly reserved for the Northern Paiute Native Tribe. Ironically, the legal basis for starting a fight with the federal government is that sovereignty really belongs to Oregon rather than to the Paiutes, who have seen their federal trust land shrink over 1.5 million acres to a tiny remnant of 760 acres in Burns, Oregon, where this current armed standoff began. Cliven Bundy is a Nevada rancher who is engaged in an armed standoff with the federal government in 2014 when some of his cattle were seized over 20 years of unpaid grazing fees. Militia members and patriots from all the western states and phototropic politicians from as far away as Arizona joined Bundy. Video at the time showed militiamen taking aim at federal officers, and the authorities decided a bloodbath over grazing fees was not sensible. When the federal agents stood down, the militias declared a major victory. Last Saturday, January 2nd, the war over federal authority continued when an unknown number of militia members seized a building at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, and Ammon Bundy, Cliven Bundy's son, released a video urging like-thinking people to arm themselves and come to Oregon, declaring, "We're going to be staying for several years." The militiamen claimed the occupation of an empty building was accomplished with 150 armed men. The armed occupation of Malheur Wildlife Refuge grew out of a demonstration over the impending deadline for Steve Hammond, aged 46, and his father, Dwight Hammond, aged 73, to report to federal custody to begin serving 5 years in prison each for arson on public lands. At the Hammonds' trial, the government argued that the fires were set to cover up evidence of poaching activities. The Hammonds did not deny setting fires, but claimed their purpose was to destroy invasive species. In the 2014 standoff, Cliven Bundy claimed the federal agents had no authority in Nevada. He now claims the same of Oregon, stating Saturday, "United States Justice Department has no jurisdiction or authority within the state of Oregon." If anything is clear-cut about Indians in the Constitution, it is that relations with Indian nations are a federal responsibility. Carrying out that responsibility in Oregon, U.S. President U.S. Grant established the Malheur Indian Reservation for the Northern Paiute in 1872. It is no coincidence that the historical reservation shares a name with the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, site of the current armed standoff. White settlement nibbled at the Malheur Indian Reservation until the Bannock War of 1878, which ended with the surrender of the Paiutes and the Bannocks on the reservation being removed officially to the Yakima Reservation in Washington Territory. Unofficially, Paiutes had scattered all over the western states that comprised their aboriginal lands. The Burns Paiute Reservation is the remains of the Malheur Reservation, and the Malheur Wildlife Refuge is an alternative use for the federal land for those who believe the federal government exists. As in Nevada, the Bundys claim their only lawful authority in the area is the Harney County Sheriff David Ward, who they have petitioned to take the Hammonds into protective custody from the U.S. Marshal. In a video posted on YouTube, Ammon Bundy said, "This is a time to stand up." Willamette Week reported that militia members have been arriving in Burns, Oregon for weeks. John Ritzheimer made a farewell video for his family before heading out to fight with the oppressive, tyrannical federal government and posted it on YouTube. If he were not promising to die a free man, his rant about the Constitution would be humorous. While he would fail my constitutional law course, his unusual reading of the document loses some humor value when he offers it as a reason to lay my life down to fight against tyranny, tyranny put in place by kids who never got their hands dirty, who went off to college and came back thinking they knew as much about land management as farmers. Ammon Bundy claims on video to be doing God's work and says of the 2014 standoff, "Because people came, we are free." He also claims that the U.S. attorney threatened to get the Hammonds assigned to a less desirable prison if they kept consulting with the militia, and that would be a death sentence. Urging people to join in, he referred to the occupation of the wildlife refuge as this wonderful thing that the Lord is about to accomplish. The Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, a church the Ammons belong to, stated that they disavowed the claims of Ammon Bundy and that there was no church business involved in the takeover. The Oregonian reported that one of the occupiers is Ryan Payne, an Army veteran who claimed to have organized snipers to target federal agents during the 2014 standoff at the Bundy Ranch in Nevada. Another veteran of the Bundy standoff, Blaine Cooper, told the Oregonian, "I went there to defend Cliven with my life." Oregonian coverage was up to date as of early January 3rd and included this statement on the situation from Harney County Deputy Sheriff David Ward. After the peaceful rally was completed today, a group of outside militants drove to the Malheur Wildlife Refuge, where they seized and occupied the refuge headquarters. A collective effort from multiple agencies is currently working on a solution. For the time being, please stay away from that area. More information will be provided as it becomes available. Please maintain a peaceful and united front and allow us to work through this situation. According to reporting by the Associated Press, the Hammonds are not as quick to advocate shooting at federal officers as Cliven Bundy. The AP quoted a letter from the Hammond family lawyer, W. Allen Schroeder, to Sheriff Ward. Neither Ammon Bundy nor anyone within his group or organization speak for the Hammond family. Dwight Hammond himself told the AP that he and his father intended to turn themselves in on January 4th, which they have done. "We gave our word that's what we want to do, and we intend to act on it." While state and federal law enforcement agencies discussed how to end the occupation without bloodshed, Cliven Bundy from his Nevada ranch and occupiers in the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge used social media to call for supporters to come to Oregon and to come armed. And in an update from today's news, the Sheriff David Ward has asked Ammon and his followers to leave, and as of this afternoon, Ammon Bundy declined to take up the sheriff's offer. This story was found in the Earth First Newswire at www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And big old trees are the local solution to climate change in this story by Natalyn DeLapp of the Environmental Protection Information Center. While much of the activism, politics, and media around global warming rightly focuses on the reducing the use of fossil fuels and stopping pipelines that threaten to expand fossil fuel use, the forests of the Northwest California are quietly absorbing vast amounts of carbon, rivaling the most productive ecosystems on Earth and sustaining natural communities and services humans depend on. Big old trees are our local solution to global climate change. The Environmental Protection Information Center will champion the important role our forests play in carbon sequestration and climate change. Northern California is home to four of the top 10 carbon-storing national forests in the country. Our forests breathe the excess carbon dioxide caused by burning of fossil fuels and store the carbon in their trunks, roots, and surrounding soil for centuries if allowed to grow. Let me explain. As trees grow, they suck up carbon dioxide from the air and trap it in their trunks, limbs, roots, and leaves, or to use a fancy science term, this carbon is sequestered. As a tree grows, it becomes a carbon sink, storing more carbon than it emits. And the bigger the tree, the more carbon can be stored away. Logging short-circuits this process and accelerates the transfer of stored carbon back into the atmosphere. This is especially important in regards to old-growth forests. If a tree had been pulling from the atmosphere for 700 years, as many old-growth redwoods on the North Coast have, then if that tree is cut down, it will emit significant amounts of carbon that had been stored for hundreds of years. Just like fossil fuels, this carbon had long ago been removed from the carbon cycle. Like stepping on a gas pedal in your car, logging these high-carbon forests will only speed up global climate change by releasing a sudden influx of long-stored carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Recruiting and preserving big old trees is like hitting the brakes, slowing our rate of carbon emissions by keeping carbon in the trees. This story from the Environmental Protection Information Center, you can find their webpage at www.wildcalifornia.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced by Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of the Earth First Update, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. on Friday. If you're in Moscow, Idaho, you can listen to 90.3 KRFP Radio Free Moscow at 1:15 on Wednesday afternoons right after Democracy Now! Or you can go online to radioforall.net, where you can listen or download this or any previous version of the Earth First Update. And if you like what you hear, please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to carry the Earth First Update. It is free to download. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.